Welcome to Equal Time Soccer. I'm Matt Pavratsky alongside Crystal Seidel, formerly, maybe folks know her as Crystal Coleman during her playing days. Crystal, how's it going? You're out in Ohio coaching for Wright State. It's been a long time since you've been on the show. What's going on?
Yeah, it's going great here in Ohio. So a little different than the last couple of times we talked. Different location, a lot of newness going on, but we're in a really good spot.
All right. So we mentioned you're at Wright State. Wait, I forgot. I almost forgot to kick things off. We're pouring out a modest for myself. It's Friday happy hour. Modest supports Equal Time Now. Look at this live pour. Look at this content we're giving for people. That's good. All right. That's enough. So Crystal, you are at Wright State in the Horizon League, just finished your first fall out there. What's it been like to sort of learn a new team and get in the swing of it, but also a new team in a new conference?
It's been great. Actually, it's been really great. I think the biggest challenge is probably working for someone different, and that I've experienced before because I had two different head coaches that I supported at Minnesota. But the guy I work for now it's totally different than the two women I worked for prior. So I think building that relationship over the summer, even before the season started, was kind of the beginning of my experience with Wright State. And then, we've talked about things like that before, but like gaining trust of players and trying to figure out what motivates who and some of those things just made it really exciting to have to go down some of those paths with a different program.
Yeah, especially you'd spent so long in Minnesota, like building your reputation. All the youth clubs knew you, all the players knew you, like everyone's older sister or older cousin had heard of you. And so like all these like tangents, these little webs that go out and just like give you this reputation. And you and I met, of course, when I started covering the Gophers forever ago in like 2016, 2017. And you've been a longtime staff member there. Transitioned from being the lead assistant with the Gophers to then being the head coach at McAllister. And I remember chatting with you after you'd been the head coach at McAllister for a little bit, and all the things that all this new perspective of having to go from an assistant to being a head coach, and it helps you realize, like, appreciate the nuances between those different roles. Now that you're back in a D1 assistant role, is there any new sort of perspective that you gained too of sort of those flips back and forth of changing the perspective and changing the role?
Yeah, I think so for sure. I think it helped me understand the assistants when I was at McAllister and like gave me appreciation. I mean, I remember calling Steph and being like, oh, this makes so much sense. This is how you must have felt and it's how you feel after games and things. But now like going back into assistant coach role, I think I'm a better coach from being a head coach. I think I have better understanding of that role too. So I think it helps me become a better assistant and interact with the players maybe even differently than I did the first time around.
Yeah, I think Cheryl Reeve, the head coach and GM of the Lynx, one time mentioned when she got to be an assistant on the Olympic team and she was interviewed by like Jim Suan or whoever, and they didn't interview with her. And she's like, yeah, I don't know what my assistants are complaining about. This is so easy.
Oh, I wouldn't say that. I wouldn't say I'm walking away saying this is so easy, but
she was like, yeah, this is great. I just like go to practice and like let the head coach deal with the dynamics. This is cake. What's the problem?
Yeah, there is some of that element, right? You get to show up and just help
a lot of time. Hey, listen, I'm doing my job. I'm letting you do your job. Totally. Well, let's go all the way back. I don't know, even when we've had you on shows before, I don't know if I've ever chatted with you in depth at all or even at all about your sort of college playing decision. So you started your college playing career at West Virginia, which back then was in the Big East, which I loved having that random memory of your and my college years, the previous conference alignment era. And then you transferred to the U to finish out your career, which is, transferring back then was much different than transferring now. But even talk about how you ended up at West Virginia, your search back then and what part of the recruiting process you remember. Cause I think even, wasn't that long ago, but even compared to now, I feel like it's just a different landscape, a different vibe to how players get recruited and how players consider all that stuff.
Yeah, I think my experience was unique. I think that's always the case, right? Everyone has their own like path. The way I remember it, which is probably skewed at this point, is I was on the cusp of like, I was on a really good club team in Minnesota, and we did ODP back then. That was like super prevalent on picking the national teams and the region teams. And I did not make the top region team. And I thought I had been playing really well when I was 17 years old, right around college decision time. And I remember putting something on my mirror in my bathroom to try to motivate me. And I was really out to like prove that everyone was wrong. And I was a better player than I was given credit for. So what I remember is that West Virginia sent me a piece of paper that had, they were 15th in the country at the time. I think they finished, this came off a Sweet 16 year. So like at the end of that season, they were ranked 15th and it was highlighted with the top 25. And like, for me, I think I visited quite a few other schools. And then when I got down to the end of it, I decided the most important thing to me was going to the best program I could to prove myself, even if that meant I wasn't going to play right away.
Right.
I worked my way into the lineup. And so that is how that decision happened. And I think I remember my club coach telling me like a few months after, or maybe after my first season, that he was shocked because it was like the only college that he didn't actually speak, the university that he didn't actually speak to on behalf of any player. Like I just went because of the piece of paper,
right, made
one conversation with an assistant coach and just pulled the trigger on it versus like someone who built a relationship with me over a course of a long time. So, but that was my mission, was to prove I was a better player than I was given credit for at the time.
Well, and that's, I think it's a little rare too, even just the idea that they found you entirely of their own accord really means, like, especially given the context you shared, the idea that you quote unquote weren't on the top team or whatever really means someone on their staff was looking for you or watching a certain game or whatever, because that's, you know, otherwise, like you said, the youth coach, like sort of repping you out to programs they know is a big part of the recruiting process too. So it's, did you ever find out like what made them get you on their radar? Like what random assistant was watching one random game or like the state tournament or something like that?
I knew there was a coach there whose last name was Duper, who that's the one I talked to. So I think she had potentially identified me. I don't know, you know, how programs work. Like I think I was on a list and she was, might've been the person to call me. I don't know if she saw me or what.
Right.
I can't remember how any of those conversations shook out, but definitely they would have saw me somewhere. I don't know if it would have been regionals back then, or we did a couple like showcase type tournaments, but it was a totally different landscape than it is now. Like there's so many different tournaments and that, I mean, it's just being a recruiter in this moment, there's a lot more to navigate than the handful of tournaments that used to be big showcase items and the, you know, handful of regionals. Now there's like three or four different regionals that you have to attend, you know?
It's even like playing at the crazy, like expensive high level club stuff now is just, especially for me growing up so rural and playing such crappy, like low level soccer my entire life. Like I can't even relate, like the amount of travel kids do alone, like just the national like schedules, the, all the tournaments, like you mentioned, the flights, the hotels, it's just the commitment from basically like 12, 13, 14 for some of these girls is just wild. Like I don't know if it feels that way to you or if that was sort of starting around the time you were playing, but it's like, does it feel that extreme to someone like you too, who you were playing at a high level, but just that progression that's been happening like the last decade or so?
Yeah, it's definitely changing for sure. I mean, I played in my local club till I was 15 and then went to this team that was formed out of ODP back then. And now it's like that people jump so much earlier and, and there is no, like, not no, but I mean, in the community I was in, Woodbury Soccer Club doesn't really exist in the way that it used to. Like it combined with a bunch of other communities. And even like my nephews are traveling sometimes 40 minutes to games when they're 8 years old. Like it's definitely totally different. And I would say here in the Cincinnati area where I live, I feel like they are probably 10 to 15 years earlier than Minnesota was at creating some of those super clubs and super teams. So there's a lot of that that happens here too.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. I mean, by the time, you know, you're at, and you go to West Virginia, you succeed, you're playing from day one, you play, I think like every game of those first 3 years or whatever it is, you know, you're just a stalwart right away. And then what'd you say?
Every minute of every game.
Every minute. Well, that's sort of, I feel like that's sort of like a Coleman thing. This is like a legendary, like it's like almost like a Coleman Iron Woman stat is, I think it was like your sister Cassie at one point had the NWSL record for like minutes played or something. You have these, like playing every minute of your first 3 years at D1 is just like ridiculous. Like this is just.
it was partially positional. Backs very much.
Still, we'll still give it to you. We'll give it to you. So you end up with the Gophers on what ended up being a pretty legendary 2008 team. Your sister is on the your other sister, Kylie, is on the team then. You all go to the Sweet 16, part of sort of a three-year stretch of two different deep runs under Mickey Denny Wright. That 08 team is sort of a who's who of some equal time favorites, of some like of some familiar faces. The Kelsey Hood, Jenny Clark, Molly Rouse, Kat Parkhill was on that team. Like I said, your sister Kylie was on that team. Yeah. What do you remember about that year in particular? Because I mentioned 2010 was another deep run, but you in particular in 08 being sort of an incoming transfer as a leader, but also new. But yeah. What do you remember from that year where you all went like 22-4, win the Big Ten, just ridiculous? I mean, 22-4 in college soccer is absurd. Like even very, very good teams do not have that kind of win percentage. That doesn't happen. What do you remember from that year?
A lot. I remember all four losses. We lost to Penn State twice, Michigan State once, and Notre Dame to end the season. I remember just being very fortunate because they went through a lot to get to that point as a program. I think you'd have to look back. I can't remember what year it was for Mickey, if it was like 4 or 5, but obviously it's like right around that time where you can see a lot of the players that she came in. Like my class was her first class and they were seniors. I think Foley was hers that she brought in. She might've brought in half of the class ahead of them, but it was the time where they were veteran. They've gone through every experience possible in the 3 years prior. So I think I was lucky enough just to be there when they were getting all like the fruit of that labor. So I just remember it like just being, it was just awesome season, right? We were battling hard, but winning. So that makes you want to like come back and train hard again, cause you're having some success. And we went undefeated in the non-conference. That was the first 10 wins. And then we lost the first Big Ten game. And it was like a wake-up call. Like, hey, maybe we're not all we think we are. We lost it, I think, 2-1, maybe 2-0. We got shut out for the first time, I think, on the year too. And then we just kind of turned it on after that. So it was a lot of fun. But I think I was very fortunate to show up when I did to get to experience all the hard work that they had already put in.
That's sort of an interesting dynamic too. You mentioned like being undefeated through those 10 games, but getting that wake up call. Cause I think the more realistic version of a quote unquote, like undefeated or really unbelievable season is that you sort of need that loss. You know, a lot of coaches even say this when they go through seasons like that, like if you don't get that wake up call before the playoffs, you're at risk of getting it in the playoffs and then you're knocked out. Do you remember that sort of wake up call being valuable in terms of, we're not as hot shit as maybe we think we are. We have to lock in this way or that way. Like, does it have that kind of a value of, yes, we're very good, but this is a reminder that if we're not at the top of our game, you know, someone can take a game from you. It's the Big Ten.
Yeah, I think for sure it established that. I think it also like the recognition that the level of opponents we were playing in our non-conference schedule was not what we were about to face. So I think even right. just having that in the first game be like that hard of a challenge and then taking the L was like, step it up, right? Step it up. Cause the opponents you're not going to get away with bad habits at this point.
Right. Yeah. I always tell people, if people have not followed, for example, like the Gophers or another team I've covered, and the Gophers are the team I've covered the longest, I always tell people, even like immensely talented crews during my time covering the program have like always had moments where they played a competition. Like they'll play up to Rutgers, you know, in a random year, and a year where Indiana's at the bottom of the table, they'll lose 3-1 or what, you know, whatever, because it's just really hard. I mean, it's really hard to do the two games on every weekend. It's hard for the 3-month sprint. It's hard to be a student athlete. It's hard to be an athlete in general. Like, it's the pressures of it, the stresses of it. And a lot of these are like kids, like some of these players are like teenagers. And so it's just legitimately really hard. And I try and remind myself of that in the coverage, but also just random people following the program. Like, it's sort of human nature to play to competition anyway, let alone adding all those pressures on top of it. And yeah. So like you need those signals of like, oh yeah, shit, we have to wake up. Like, we have to get going.
Yeah. And I think conferences, like, I mean, I even say in our conference, like that's one of the things that I'm excited to sell to recruits is like when the top to bottom is close, like there is no big buffer gap. Like I think on the bottom of the Big Ten's worst year, the top of the Big Ten can lose a game because there's enough talent there and when the right things click, that, I mean, you got to put one in the back of the net. I mean, we had a couple of times in the 2013 season when I was coaching where we'd get outshot like 22-1 and beat Penn State and Michigan both 1-0 and make it to the NCAA tournament. So like, it doesn't, right. That's the game of soccer for you. So it's right. Really exciting and fun, you know?
Well, and it's, I love that you mentioned even like your current setup in the Horizon League, because now that St. Thomas is D1 and now that Mark, you know, for my brother for Equal Time is covering Minnesotans playing D1 at other programs, I have so much more visibility to like the Summit League, the Horizon League, Missouri Valley Conference, like all these mid-majors and, you know, quote unquote, non-Power 5 or whatever that cover the Midwest, like the upper Midwest. They're just, all of those conferences have Minnesotans in them. And so like being aware of the random programs I never would have followed before, like UNI and Green Bay and, you know, I mean, list all of them where all of these players come from. And places like the Horizon League, it's like, yeah, there might be a power player here and there. You might have the Milwaukees of the world or the whoever's, but every other game is like, you better be up to play. You better be ready to go, because every game is gettable, but that also means every game is losable. Like, you better be ready. And so it's having that where like the slate is just filled with all these winnable games. I love the fact that it also means they all can be losable, and it's sort of like, don't take anyone for granted, because like, you might think you can crush this team, but like UIC might come get you, like, you don't know.
Absolutely.
Nice. Well, and one thing I wanted to get your opinion on, the last handful of seasons, you know, for the Gophers in general, but also just following so many programs, one dynamic that seems to come back, like sneak into my brain over and over, is the need for teams to have sort of individual players who are capable of taking over either a game that slogs down into a 0-0 grind or a game that slogs down into just not much of a run of play. You know, college games get that way. The second game of a weekend, or a field happens to be tiny and a team likes to box you in, or a team likes to park the bus and force you to shoot from distance and just go for a draw. But the need to have an individual player who can be a game breaker, who sort of wants to take it on and just decide, okay, it's not that I'm like arrogant or screw the rest of the team, but at a certain point, it does feel like you notice when teams don't have someone who can break that game. And the example I recently did when I was talking about the Gophers example was like in 2018, the team had a lot of talent, a lot of seniors, the Fiedlers of the world, the Hessens of the world, you know, so many good longtime contributors. But the player who I thought really, you know, flipped a switch and changed the destiny of that year was when April Bakken just started playing out of her mind the second half of that fall. Yeah. And all of a sudden the Gophers go into the Big Ten as a low seed, rip through the entire conference tournament, win the conference tournament, win a game in the NCAAs. And it came right after the year where the Gophers had been burst on the bubble, didn't get into the tournament. I think you and others probably felt like you got screwed a little bit. But 18, like that light switch took away the risk of the bubble. It cemented the path to the NCAAs. And it's not to discredit what everyone else on that team did. There was a great defense, a great unit. Everyone was really good. But I think anyone that followed that team saw what Bakken going to the next level did for that squad. And it's the one example of many that I can think of where having a player who's able to just break the game, you know, just by herself can rip off a pass, go score, and all of a sudden the game has changed, because a goal can change an entire game. But for you as a coach, is that dynamic, has that always been something that's prevalent? Am I sort of overrating that? Or, you know, is that something you track as you sort of try and find a player who might have that potential? Or how do you think about that dynamic?
Yeah, I think that's obviously, I think a lot of people look for that, because I think that is an answer to a lot of questions, you know, especially when things like from a cumulative standpoint, like how we're going to defend as a unit or how we're going to attack as a unit starts to break down for, like you mentioned, a variety of reasons. So certainly, I think that's always the plan, is to try to recruit that or recruit the potential for that. I do think there's the next level would be having multiple of those kids, so that it doesn't turn into, okay, April Bakken's on, shut down April Bakken and we'll win this game, right? Then you have someone else kind of appear. So I always think it's good to have a roster where you feel like there's multiple people with that potential, and it's just about trying to get them on when they're needed, right? And that's like, you know, a lot to do with them, but also like that's what coaches are hoping to be able to help kind of let those players rise to those occasions.
Well, and in a game itself, to build on that, in the game, like if you're in a game where it's slogging down, you're on the road, it's 0-0 or it's 1-1, you know, the offense just isn't quite clicking or whatever, and it's 60th minute, 70th minute, whatever it is, for you as a coach, how do you try and get unlock that from the player? Let's say you do feel like you have one or two or three or whatever, like attacking mids or wingers or forwards or whoever's that you do think has that potential, but it's not happening yet. Yeah. How do you try to is it literally just you like zoning in with the player and being like, it is time. I need you. Go make a play on the ball.
Yeah. I think we don't have enough, as much control as we wish we did. Right. Like I think that's what we're limited to, is maybe having those conversations or maybe just helping them see what is working for them in those moments. I think maybe sometimes like just identifying the spaces that they are having success or like the people they're having against and encourage them to confidently take risks and go and be, I think that's one of the biggest issues I see is just that confidence of like, of working through the failure. Right.
Right.
Like you talk about Michael Jordan, just continuing to take shots when things aren't going well. Like, I think that is a challenge for a lot of athletes, male and women, particularly women, you know, eventually confidence starts to go down and they're not willing to get on the ball and keep trying with that much failure. So I think that's just trying to eliminate like, no, we're doing what you want. You're doing exactly what you need to like take those risks and have that confidence and it will come, you know, and just try to motivate or inspire or just get them to believe in themselves a lot, but it doesn't always work.
Well, you mentioned the confidence thing of like, you know, at like someone as an individual, maybe if the game isn't going super well, they lose that confidence. I'm curious about even the inverse too, of when someone's trying to be a really good teammate. Like I sometimes when I interview players post game, and even not on the record, but I'm chatting with players post game, and they say things like, oh, we have such a good vibe. Like we have such a good, you know, we're so supportive of each other. Like everyone is really rooting for each other. And that's not bad. I'm not saying that's bad, but sometimes that becomes such a prevalent thing that people say that I wonder if individual players then also worry about quote unquote ruining that vibe by trying to be too individual. Like I almost wonder if the sheer amount of positivity and supportive vibe sometimes makes a player think like, well, I don't want to ruin this vibe. Like I don't want to make everyone think I'm, you know, I'm Kobe and I'm just going to go and I need to take shots and I'm going to keep it and take on three defenders. So I wonder if like the inverse also happens where players feel the need to come across as good teammates and be good teammates and support sort of like their best friends and what amounts to be almost like their sisters. Yeah. Like you feel like that's a dynamic too, where it's, you almost feel like if the vibe is good, the pressure to not like quote unquote ruin it by being too individual. Like I'm super curious about that too.
Yeah. No, I think that happens a lot. We've been talking about that this spring of like separate yourself. And then when they'll come, right? Like, I think a group will follow and also separate. And then that becomes the new, you know, zone where we all start to feel comfortable together again. And then we need people to separate again so that so it elevates. Otherwise we're going to stand still. So that's definitely a big thing of like, yeah, lead by the front, but don't just eke through right at the front, like blow it away and then let the expectation rise a little bit.
I love that way of saying it, just because I do think like, I try and have our coverage. Like I love the hype side of what we do. Like I feel like the very first Gopher game I went to, I grew up in rural northern Minnesota. I had no idea about the Gopher soccer team. Like they would have never been on my radar. I grew up in a town of 1,000 people. Like my parents were not soccer people. Like I just grew up playing. And Brian Karstead, who people don't know, who ran Inside Minnesota Soccer News forever and wrote about soccer forever and has probably written 1,000 stories about the Coleman family in his life. He took me to a Gopher soccer game in 2016. And that game, the first half, I was like, holy shit, this stadium is amazing. This team is amazing. It was the year the team won the double. They won the regular season and the Big Ten. Like, you know, Simone Kalander, Rashida Beal, like, Ace Josie, like stacked team, like crazy team. And the whole first half, I was like, holy shit, this team is so unbelievably fun to watch. What a venue. This is so cool. Full stands, blah, blah, blah. And by the second half, I was completely pissed off because I was like, well, wait a second. If they're so good and this venue is so good and these vibes are so good, how have I never heard of this team? And that's what made me start covering the program, because it was just the idea of, these players deserve some hype, man. They're balling out. We have all Americans out here. Like, we have pros. We have these badass players. So like you said, the idea of breakthrough, like go get it. And frankly, the rest of the team will cheer for you. And like folks like me will cheer for you, but like, get nuts, show what you got. And then the rest of your team will go join you. I love that part of the mentality, because I think I don't know if I'm overstretching, but it feels like, especially as like women athletes or even just women, like no one is socialized to be like, it can be about you. Like it can be about you. Like it should be about you. We should be celebrating the shit out of you. But it's like, no women are socialized to think that. They're socialized to think like, well, yeah, men get spotlight and it's cool and we're just trying our hardest and we should be happy with scraps. It's like, no, dude, get the spotlight. You earned it.
Yeah. I think there's a little bit of truth to some of that.
I'll take that little bit of truth to some of that. I'll take that to the bank. I'll take it. Well, we've made it 26 minutes in and I haven't brought up the press yet. So I deserve a trophy for this. Crystal, okay. You probably get to avoid getting sick of me talking about the press. I think teams running a high defensive press is like, somehow in my mind, it would solve every team's problems. And I think it's a magical solution. I think it's super fun. I think it would bring goals and everything in soccer would be solved. People are sick of me hyping up the press, but legitimately some of my earliest memories of covering women's soccer in Minnesota was watching sort of what I think objectively has been described as your press, the system you helped install, like with the Gophers. Players credit you with like creating that sort of very effective like high line press in the 4-3-3 that was such a staple of the team's identity back then. I don't know if I've ever actually asked you this, to just ask about sort of the origins of sort of the value you find in running a system like that, how you have introduced that into your coaching now and even back then, and just in general, sort of what you think that brings to a team and what's valuable about it.
The press, my mentality towards the press started as a player at Minnesota, because that's how we played that year that we had a lot of success with the 22 wins. And that came from Mickey actually played at UNC for two seasons. So she got to see the press at the high, I mean, she played with Mia Hamm. So she got to see it really destroy teams. So it became like, that is what we will be doing. And there is, I mean, I think early we put out, I think the team had like, there is like, we are, will be pressing, like pressing is who we are. And so we did it that year. And we spent a lot of time, we played a 3-5-2 that year, talking about how the outside wingers were going to crack down on the backs and we're not going to let them breathe, you know, coming out. And I think just over, I mean, that course of the next few years, we did it in a variety of systems. And when Steph came in 2016, that was a big part of our identity. We had a lot of different things going on in the attack, but we did probably score 10, 15 goals that year off of the pressure we created in the final third. So I just think as the years went on, we refined some of the language around it, and just more people came into it. You know, we talk about it in the recruiting process. So it was like years and years of just that pressing. This is how we do it and where we do it and how we do it as a unit. And just got really good eventually.
Mm-hmm. The reason I probably speak so strongly about it is just because when it's on, you know, like when the press is working, it's just one of the coolest things to watch. I mean, like when it's rolling and the team knows how to do it, it just defines everything about the run of play, because you are dictating how the other team plays. So it's, you are dictating the run of play, but you also are creating so many opportunities for yourself. You're sort of forcing the other team to play your way, but you're also just, there's so much opportunity with it. There's so much low-hanging fruit to it. And obviously it's not going to work with every player group. Like not every formation will work right. Not every press is the same. Like there's so many caveats to it that like, you can't just say, you know, when I say a team should like run a press, that's not really saying an idea. Like that's suggesting a possible 15 different ideas that may or may not be terrible. But it's just when you see it work for a team, it's so hard to not remember that image, because when it unlocks, the entire game is dictated by that one tactical, like, formational strategy. So I don't, when you've been at other places, like you mentioned, it took years to install and build as that sort of expectation. And then it was such a core piece of what those teams did, because it started with the recruits and they knew, and then they come in learning it from the veteran players. And then it's, once you build the infrastructure, it's sort of self-sustaining in a way. Or not self-sustaining, but it's more sustainable. But then when you've been at new places, how has sort of been with new rosters from scratch or new teams or new coaching staffs, how has that changed the way you view either that or even other tactical things where it's like, well, we're starting from zero, or you're coming into a staff that already has a tactical plan? How has that changed the way you think about sort of those tools?
Yeah. I think for me, I'm like you, I love the passion of like putting them under from goalkeeper out, and I want to press everywhere in my ideal world. But in some of the environments I've been in, I think personnel wise, like there hasn't been that capability, like even my first couple of years at McAllister. So we would try to like, okay, how do we start the path of building this idea of like, once it gets to this certain zone, how do we pressure in that way? Even if we don't have the capability of covering that much ground because of the personnel we had, can we start with the mentality of it in a tighter space? So you drop a line of confrontation and you still like consider it pressing, even though it's not full court press, full field press. So I think that was kind of the biggest thing. But I mean, for me, even on our path to McAllister, I was recruiting players who eventually we were going to be able to press higher and harder. Like that was a part of what we were hoping to recruit when I was there. And I will say that is the path we are on at Wright State as well. I think the team that we will have in fall of 2024, the personnel we have, is built to press significantly higher, harder, and over more distances than the team we had in 2023 even. And I'm sure every year we will feel that way, because we're looking for that when we recruit. Like we're looking for players who we think can get pressure on the ball and cover ground in that way.
And is it, what, talk about the mix of sort of what, when you went, like when that, when you describe a certain type of player or the types of players who can fit into that, I'm assuming it's a mixture of just literal fitness and physical tools. Like a certain piece of it is that, like, can you truly close out this gap quicker? Do you have the burst? Do you have the energy to run this for, you know, in D1 college soccer, a minimum of like a 15-minute shift? Can you do a 30-minute shift? Yeah. Are you a terminator who can, you know, play 70 or 90 minutes in the midfielder attack, you know, to do it too? So it's like a physical tools thing. But then how is that? Because I think that's a little bit more of an eye test that almost anyone could see of like, oh, they're in such good shape. They're, look at their work rate, blah, blah, blah. But the tactical side, is that part of it too, where like, do they have, you know, do they have the ability to pick up the nuances of, okay, I'm supposed to read this zone once the ball gets here versus, you know, when they swing the ball across, that's when you cue off of this versus I cue off of another player, or however you're cueing that system. Yeah. What's the tactical process like of seeing if a player has the ability to pick that stuff up? Like, how do you scout that? Or even how do you feel that out of, do they have the ability to learn this new tactic or formation or whatever?
Yeah, I think it's hard to change mentality of speed of transition, I think. So when you watch players, like even like, you know, players that play, not that they can't ever do it if they're asked to, but there's players that play in the nine role that aren't asked to put pressure
right
heavily. And you watch them in a game and you just want, it's a question mark, right? Like you want to get them in your environment, those, you want to invite them to camp to see like, if I ask this, will they do that? Because they're just asked to play something totally different.
Right.
So it's easier certainly when you go to watch teams that they have players that naturally like, ball is lost, where am I moving to help us get it back, right? Like you can see that. And I think even when I watch, I know I gravitate towards those players because I know how I enjoy playing. And I'm very lucky I'm working for a man who also enjoys playing in the same way I enjoy playing. So I don't have to change what I'm looking for just to fit the program. But I write that down, like speed of transition in midfield is excellent, or like speed from defensive to attack is excellent. Like that's part of my notes when I go out recruiting. So beyond like the physical ability to, it's the like mental engagement and willingness to recognize those moments. And I think we're more hesitant to take a risk on someone who doesn't naturally do those things because it is like that mentality is difficult to switch.
Well, and you mentioned recruiting, even outside of like the press or the, you know, which is where we started this, but even just in general in recruiting, do you find it then easier to recruit players who play in a system that seems vaguely similar to what you want to do? Like, is it then that much easier to be like, well, they want their nines to do exactly what I want our nines to do, or they're asking their sixes to do, you know, pretty much what we want. And so I can sort of, does it make it a little bit simpler of like, well, it's a pass fail now because I know what this coach asked for and they're asking at least vaguely similar to what I would ask and I'm not seeing it. Is it sort of, how is that difference between when you're watching those clubs that maybe are playing similar to what you want versus when you have to maybe parse those clues a little bit more sort of in your own brain of like, well, but they're not really asking their wingers to pinch and I kind of want my wingers to invert and cut in, whatever. Does it make it, you know, sort of really different based on the system you're seeing them in and seeing in that similar system? Does it make it that much easier?
Yeah, I think so. You're evaluating a bunch of different stuff though, right? So like maybe there's someone who's not playing the same way you are, but they have some special talent that, you know, technically or some special element of physical ability, pace, mm-hmm. something like that. And those players that, you know, have, you know, something that's at the top of the game that could help your team with a different need. Maybe you take a chance on establishing some of the other behaviors, but it's definitely easier to say this person plays like us. They're going to fit in right away and contribute right away. Cause our preseason's so short, especially that first year, you know, it's like, you have like 2 weeks to get organized. It's so like adding, that's why like over time it gets good. Cause if you don't have 3/4 of your roster already knowing how the press is working, like it's probably going to come with a lot of failure your first few weeks of season. And for our program, we use our non-conference schedule to prepare for conference play because we're one big conference, right? We have to win the conference to make the NCAA tournament. But certainly like the Gopher, I mean, they have to win. They have to have success immediately. So whatever, a lot of their work comes in the spring or the years leading up or just having a cohesive style over time and being able to just kind of recruit and build into it.
Right. I really, that's such a good point of like your conference landscape matters so much to how you then handle your non-conference. And like you mentioned, you know, the Gophers, not only do they need to get results, they sort of have to balance the, do we want the higher chance of wins? Do we want the higher RPI that'll risk the loss, but it'll strengthen us later on. And then even in a place like the Summit League, you know, when I've done these prep calls with coaches, like across the Summit League, which is another one bid conference. I mean, I guess maybe in a magical season, someone could squeak in, but basically the Summit and the Horizon are like, you have to win to get in. Yeah. And I've heard different coaches speak to it differently where they say like, well, I know Coach X likes to bring up those wins because they want to ramp into conference really hot. Like they want to get wins and come in rolling. And then the same coach said, but we like to really challenge ourselves because we know our only way to get in is winning the conference tournament anyway. So we don't care about being the number one seed or being the regular season champion or whatever. We want to just win the conference tournament and we want to sort of get our ass. I'm paraphrasing, like get our asses kicked a little bit in non-conference, because if we have to go in the NCAAs and go play, you know, if you're a Midwest one bid team and you have to go play like Notre Dame or Wisconsin or whoever, they're like, well, I'd rather our kids like get beat up a little bit, because then they're not going to be shocked when they're starting to get beat up when they're playing insert power five Midwest team X. So it is interesting. It's a really, especially now, even with conference expansion, like it is hard to balance that. Well, and for you with recruiting too, have you noticed, like, especially having multiple different roles now, that like, has your recruiting eye changed? Have, you know, how do you adjust that in different landscapes of, you had years of recruiting to a specific program under a certain coach or a couple different coaches. Then you switch from, you know, Big Ten D1 to the MIAC in D3, and you have to immediately shift sort of who you're looking for, what you're looking for. But now back into, you know, a mid-major D1, how do you adjust that recruiting eye to be like, well, I see this player, I love this player, but you know, that's a high D2. It's not a mid D1 versus, oh, well, that player could crush in D3, but maybe they'd walk on for us. How do you adjust that with those different roles?
Yeah, there's definitely a lot of that. I think I just have to, you have to see the environment you're in, and you're hoping to bring players that fit what you have and hopefully brings an element that's, that would challenge it to be better. That's always what you're hoping to do from a recruiting standpoint. So, and we tell our team now, even like, we feel like we have all the pieces to have success within it, but we're also bringing in 10 players that have different abilities that are going to push. And we hope you're developing, and we hope they're developing, and that will give us success at the end of it. But it takes a little bit to like see the environment you're in. It took me a little bit at McAllister to see, okay, what is this team? What exactly does that look like? But I think across the board, I'm always still pro the undiscovered potential that could, you know, with the right mentality, turn into something. And I think, I mean, Rashida Beal is like my favorite story of it, because she was a hard, I mean, hardcore. Yeah, I see it. I said right away.
Rashida. Let's go, baby.
She had every tool. She's the same person that you've interviewed a bunch of times. She was like that when she was 16 years old. I mean, she's an incredible young person, but like technically some of her skills were lacking for the level she was trying to play. And mm-hmm. I remember her, she played her. So her first year, she struggled with some asthmatic things and was having a hard time like with minutes on the field, but they ended up solving that. And then her sophomore year, she played a good significant amount of time. And I remember she made some big mistake in a game. And she was like, just so you know about me, like, I never make the same mistake twice. And she didn't, like, she had some learning curves. But I mean, a player like that, with that mentality, put into an environment where she's training with other great players around her and getting opportunities, she did it herself, but she just was able to explode. So, I mean, I still think we, at every program I've been at, we found those kids that maybe someone who had more success than us overlooked. I think we do that at Wright State. Like, there's players on our roster that our head coach jokes about, like, wouldn't be on a Division I roster, but she's here. And then these are players that are excelling here. So I think it's just knowing like what that potential mentality looks like, and then giving them the avenue to do it themselves, you know, the resources to kind of do it at our environment.
I love that. And I think it's like you said, you can do it at a Power 5 too. Like, you can find someone who's not rated, you know, that all the kids from like North Shore United from Wisconsin who have come to the Gophers over the years. I tell people all the time, every time like these big time clubs get referenced and like these really well-known like high brand clubs. And I tell people all the time, I'm like, listen, I'm not like an expert on the club landscape, but I just always give the example of like, somehow like Ankeny is a pipeline for the Gophers. North Shore United is a pipeline for the Gophers. I'm like, listen, we have a viewer who literally asked the question, like, what's your advice to a player who doesn't have either the access to, or maybe they can't afford, or they just can't get onto like an ECNL team, you know? Cause I think right now, just to put it bluntly, I think any random quote unquote expert on the street, if a player asks them like, what should I do if I want to go D1? It's hard to believe they wouldn't at some point be like, find your way onto an ECNL team, maybe find your way onto a GA team. Like, you have to find that club in your area, because that's where coaches are looking. But for you, who's someone who you found players from everywhere, you've recruited to every level. If someone, you know, either can't afford that or can't make their way onto it, or it's too far away or whatever, what's your advice for a player like that who wants to sort of reach their most potential, even if it's not D1? I'm someone that hates the mentality of like, you know, players have to go D1 or else it's a failure or whatever. Like, we cover really good D2 in Minnesota in the Midwest. You coached, you know, great D3 institution. Like, players should go where they want. But let's say a player just wants to meet their potential and thinks they need to go ECNL, but they can't. What's your advice for a player like that?
I think just love the ball and love the game and find ways to play it in any avenue. I mean, I think somebody on Houston, they're talking about, and I'm going to draw a blank on the name when I need it, right? But she grew up playing with boys in her neighborhood because she couldn't play on the top team. And now she's a pro in the highest level in her country, you know? Mm-hmm. I think Molly Rouse is a good example. She got to play high level club. It wasn't like she didn't play some of that, but what made Molly Rouse great, and Mickey will tell you, is she would take a ball in some cones in her backyard and she just train, because she loved it so much. So mm-hmm. if you love the game and love the ball and you put yourself on it and find just any environment that will take you and just try to get better while you're in that environment, you know, you have a chance at succeeding mm-hmm. higher than you would have, you know, with being in a top team, right? As long mm-hmm. as you're playing.
Well, and all of that work, all that individual work, that always jumps out to me so much because I grew up playing since I was 5 years old. And just, I ran a lot, like by the time I was high school age and even going into low D3 college where I was, you know, the 28th player at the University of Minnesota Morris. I ran a lot. I was always in the best shape of anybody. But I truly just never did any individual work ever. Like I wouldn't have even known I should have. Like I basically never had a coach who'd ever played soccer. I mean, like this is some rural scrappy soccer we're talking about. But that always jumps out at me of just that individual work where that's such good advice just because my touch was always, I'm going to blow your mind, trash, because I never did that individual work. Let's say someone does that, you know, you as someone who's had to recruit at these different events, or you've had to recruit based on film, or you've had to watch games. If a player feels like they have done that work, or they do have decent tape, or they do have skill, you know, do they need to try and go to some ID stuff just to get in front of people? Do they need to like send tape to 100 schools? Like what kind of methods do you think actually work versus the stuff that maybe people tell you to do, but is a lot of work that doesn't necessarily land yourself on a coach's radar?
Yeah. I think you got it right, people. It is a lot of work and sometimes very little response.
Right.
But I think you got to put your name out there and you got to do it repetitively. So it's the name becomes familiar and someone who sees it, you know, in their inbox with another 40 names
right.
Over and over always helps, like before and, you know, events or new, hey, I added a couple new highlights, or I trained in my backyard and look at this great finish I had, like whatever it is, to just keep putting your name in front of people. I think that's big. I do think there's value in like seeing somebody play at a particular level. So even if you're in like a lower level environment, it's just similar to like the question mark of like, would they play our style? Like, I think, would they rise to this level? I think it helps if you're taking a chance, especially right now with COVID rosters being so big. If you're going to take a chance on somebody, it helps to have them come to camp or experience, even just seeing them maybe in whatever environment. Like we're recruiting someone right now. It's like, well, is there anyone that you can just like guest play with that we could just see you in an environment and
right.
And do whatever evaluation we can and get closer to what we think it will take to be in our environment.
Right. There's someone who is coaching a summer league team, you know, all the different leagues that play over the summers, which are filled with a lot of like college age players. And I remember she had a player who was like reaching out to her, and the coach was like fairly high on this player, like sort of knew the pedigree, sort of knew whatever, but had never seen them play in person, and just sort of asked like, if I find like a random U17 boys team that will let you come practice, like, will you just come for 90 minutes just so I can literally see you touch a soccer ball? And just the type of thing where I'm pretty sure, but also if you're around, would you maybe just let me watch you touch a ball? Like the idea of just seeing it in person.
Division II being able to bring in players and let them train with their team is like it's such a great tool.
Like, oh, I didn't know about that.
Yeah, I'm pretty sure that's still a rule that who's allowed to do that.
That'd be great. Well, especially like during the spring. Man, during the spring, you could just like cycle through, bring in some high school juniors, get nuts.
Especially with people's depleted rosters in the spring after graduation. And mm-hmm. It would be nice.
Well, that's
not an option for us, obviously.
Since we're talking about recruiting, I do have to give a gigantic shout out to Crystal for a very long ago recruiting victory that I don't think ever got publicized much or never really got referenced. So Katie Duong, who just got drafted by her hometown Portland Thorns. I am probably one of the biggest Katie Duong nerds in the world now. She played a couple seasons at the U, was recruited by, you know, Stanford, whoever else, everyone else. And while she was at the U, I basically finished a gigantic oral history feature on her, but she was actually in the portal while it got put together. So that piece never posted. And a huge part of that piece was referencing where she, I think just verbatim, or her dad, if folks who know Hugh will appreciate this, essentially just said like, one of the reasons or the reason Katie ended up at the U was that you were recruiting her and like you were able to land her. And Katie was, you know, a bench player for Stanford and didn't see a ton of minutes, and they're such a star-studded team. I will tell people, if you have not followed Katie Duong yet, you better jump on that bandwagon now, because it is going to fill up. She is unbelievable. She is going to be a successful pro. She is going to succeed. She is like 5'3", like 115 pounds soaking wet, and she can straight up ball. And you better be ready to watch her in the pros. But I just have to give a shout out, because Crystal was named very heavily in that oral history feature that never posted anywhere but exists in my Google Drive. So shouts out to you, Crystal, for that big recruiting win. She ended up transferring to Stanford, but even her landing in Minnesota was like nutso.
I bet on her 10 out of 10 times for sure.
She, for those who don't know, and I tweeted about this, she was the star starting attacking. She was the 10 on a U20 U.S. national team that had Mia Fischel, Gurma, like Trinity Rodman. I mean, just like this roster was ridiculous. And they carved up the CONCACAF championship right before COVID shut stuff down. And so they never got to play in a World Cup. They would have just been the most fun team ever to watch in a World Cup. And you can literally, I think, go watch some of these games on YouTube. Duong was the star attacking midfielder on that team. And I will just tell you, if I'm buying every single Katie Duong stock there is, but had to shout out Katie Duong while we were there. So Crystal, you are one of a few Minnesotans coaching D1 across the country while we're having you on. We got, you know, Jenny Clark at Northwestern now, Molly Rouse, head coach down at Ole Miss, which is great. We got Molly down the SEC, baby. Campy down at Florida Gulf Coast now, was at St. Thomas for that first year. Obviously, Aaron was at DePaul, now back. Aaron Chastain now leading the Gophers. Is sort of Minnesotans and Gophers still in the coaching game? Is that something you all track or have random group texts about? Or is it something you value? Because I always love seeing these random announcements when someone gets a new job. But what do you think that means to have, you know, folks associated either with the Gopher program or Minnesota sort of coaching at these high levels and climbing that tree?
I think it's everything. I think, you know, you talk about like, if you see her, you can be her. I think that's a big thing. We all had Mickey, who was an alum who coached us. I think we had that opportunity to see her and be her a little bit. And I think that probably put it in the back of our minds, and we're all going into programs and hopefully our student athletes are seeing us and thinking like, maybe that's an avenue, a path I want to take or I want to be involved in coaching, because we need more quality women, high level women soccer players in the coaching game too, passing that on. So yeah, to even be listed with those women in a conversation like this is just special.
It's the crazy part is so many of you were on that single team and like from that era of the program too, but I just, you know, we cover so many of the Minnesota D2 programs, you know, even in D3, it just still is not that common, like for women to be hired in general, for women to get a chance to be head coaches. Like it's frankly, like, I wish it were like more rare for us to have to bring this up. Like, I wish I didn't have to keep talking about it. The fact that it's rare, like I wish it were just so normal that we never had to bring it up, but it's the reason it's so exciting when people get an opportunity, because it still is too rare. And so athletic departments, athletic directors, like, continue hiring women head, even if you're a male head coach, like, hire women on your staff. Like, it matters. It matters for the game. It matters for your players. Keep doing it. Trust me, you hire a woman, we will have her on. We will promote your program. Like, whatever it takes, we will hype you up. I do think one dynamic that gets underplayed with the challenges of having to try and progress in the coaching field is almost like the requirement to have to move across country to continue the climb. Like, I know when you and I've chatted before earlier in your career, like, even the jobs you're sort of, if you don't want to move, then the jobs you're willing to go for are incredibly limited. And then if you are willing to move, it means you have to move across the country. Like, you look at someone like Molly Rouse, who coached several places as an assistant, then had to be a head coach at a transitioning program, now gets a really big time opportunity, you know, at Ole Miss. Someone like Jenny Clark, like all the stops, you know, coaches have to go through, male or female, but like all of the stops you have to do to climb the tree, that challenge, especially someone who's like a parent, has to be just such a big part of why we don't see more folks in the field, right, Crystal?
Yeah, or like just or progressing up the field. I think too, like when you find a place that you feel you align with, your values align with, it fits your bigger picture of your family, like you can spend more time there than you would have if you're just trying to advance to the next highest level. So I think that's an important piece too. But I mean, it's not unlike other professions. It's more like, right. Cause even like people that stay in the Twin Cities in finance probably switch, you know, they're to make more money. They probably switch 4 or 5 different times, but there's just so many opportunities in such a radius. And
right.
You know, in one soccer, they're scattered all over. There's not, it's rare that there's even 2 in the same drivable distance.
Mm-hmm. Well, yeah. And you mentioned,
it's rare.
Well, and you mentioned now, I do think that's part of why I was so excited when St. Thomas announced they are going D1, not because like they magically were so positioned to be such a good D1 institution compared to anyone else. And they've done well in so many sports, and it's so cool to have them in women's soccer. But even just having the state for so long, having one D1 program had the impact you're talking about. It meant that if someone wanted to coach at the D1 level, you know, there was a one-stop shop, and otherwise you were going down to Iowa, going to the Dakotas, whatever, which is fine. Like, I'm so glad those other states, frankly, for years had more D1 programs than Minnesota, which is nuts as a Midwest guy, a Minnesota guy. But I mean, what does it mean now to have even just a second D1 program where more Minnesota players can stay home, more coaches can have the chance to coach at the D1 level, more, you know, even like referees, like officials, like fans, like all these people, just having a little more gravity around the program compared to when you and I were growing up. Like, what does that mean for Minnesota?
I think it's awesome. I think like even as a prospect coming up, it's like, if you're not going to play for Minnesota, if you can't play for Minnesota, you have to be willing to leave. And I think that drives, right, some people to choose different options, maybe because they didn't want to be far from home. I think that was kind of the beginning of some of those things. So to have more options, I think, is awesome. I mean, you look at the state of Ohio, it's insane how many Division I schools we have in this state. Like, even in the what I can drive within an hour, I mean, we have 5 from where I live within an hour, Division I. And I lived in a place where there was one, you know, the next closest one was 3.5 hours away for forever. So
right.
I think it changes even how like the youth soccer level and what people are thinking about for opportunities close to home.
Right. Right. Well, and we have a couple of, I've kept you way too long. We have a couple listener questions. One of them, could have been from anyone in the entire world. Certainly you won't be able to guess who it's from or what type of person it's from. Which Coleman sister would win in a fight? Crystal.
Oh gosh.
And you can decide what rules you're making this answer based on. And this certainly isn't from one of your sisters.
I would say me or Kylie. Just
for the grit.
I think all 3 of us have the grit. I think the force, I think the amount of force that we could produce. I think we're all, and I think our level of anger is slightly higher. I think our youngest sister, Cassie, is a little more, I don't know, less, a little less anger, a little more emotional control than the 2 of us do.
Well, let's say it came down to you and Kylie. What do you think in that matchup? Between you and her, let's pretend you're right, and then it's down to you and Kylie. What does that look like?
I think it depends on how you declare a winner. I think we're both walking out of there, or maybe not walking out of there at all. We're both giving it everything we have, dying on the sword a little bit.
you both walk away with like broken rib, dislocated whatever, bruised whatever.
If it had to be a fight to the death, I think we would be right on the edge of that.
Everyone wins, everyone loses. That's the way we'll say it for sure. And then this is completely low stakes, no risk at all. Can you name your favorite midfield group of all time, your favorite midfield trio?
Midfield trio?
No risk at all in this one.
Oh, my gosh. Midfield trio? Probably, this might hurt some feelings, it's probably the Claire Grimwood, Caitlin Wagner, Kelsey Hood trio.
Wow, that's hard to beat. Was that, would that have been, that's the 08.
The 08 trio.
It's, I won't spoil who suggested this question. It was not one of those three, but I will say if it wasn't going to be the person who made me ask this question, it's kind of hard to argue against a Kelsey Hood involved trio. Kelsey Hood is
92 wins that trio.
The if Mickey Denny Wright has a reputation for being really intense and really intimidating and somewhat extreme, Kelsey Hood's reputation is about that sized.
Yeah.
you do not talk to someone from that era of Gopher Soccer and bring up Kelsey Hood without someone being like, oh man, she was the absolute coolest, the absolute best. her reputation is very outsized. It is superhero sized for sure. All right, Crystal, anything we didn't cover, anything you want to lob my way? Otherwise, we can release you to go take care of the many human beings you are in charge of.
Nope, that's it. I'm just happy to be on the show. It's been too long.
It's been a long time.
Happy Crystal, to be back in the game.
Crystal Seidel, assistant coach out at Wright State. They are in the Horizon League, so now Minnesotans have one more reason to follow the Horizon League is on top of all the Minnesotans playing in that league out there. So good to have you on, Crystal. Good luck during your spring campaign. And maybe we'll see you back in Minnesota over the summer break. We'll see.
All right. Thanks, Matt.
Thanks.